You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
It's Friday, December 24th, and you're tuned into the Cleveland Baseball Talk Podcast. I'm Joe Noga, joined by Paul Hoynes. Hoynesy, it's Christmas Eve. It's our last show of 2021. We've reached the end, so it's time to sort of look back on everything Cleveland baseball that happened in 2021. An up and down year for sure. A historic year in a lot of ways, but really, there's just so much to talk to. We're gonna jump right in, right off the top, with January 7th of 2021, maybe a franchise-defining trade at the beginning of the year. Francisco Lindor and Carlos Carrasco headed to the Mets for Ahmed Rosario, Andrés Giménez, and a bunch of prospects.
Yeah, Joe, we knew it was coming. We just didn't know when, but the Indians, they got it done in January. It kind of struck fast, got it over with. And you see a guy like Lindor come up, you know, from the minors, the number one pick from the minors, see him develop. So in that regard, it was tough to see him go, and just how talented and what a great job he did in Cleveland. And then you see him go to New York and struggle. So it was a kind of a bittersweet moment, because everyone knew that the deal was going down.
Right. And the question at the time was, did they get enough back for Lindor, and Carrasco to a degree? You know, don't forget about Carrasco and how endeared he was to the fan base when he left as well. I think it was sort of a shock to a lot of people that, you know, they knew they were going to trade Francisco Lindor, but Carlos Carrasco going, I think, really was a shock to a lot of people. That was largely a financial move, though. You know, they having just recently signed him to an extension and, you know, trying to cut as much payroll as possible. I think the Mets taking on Carlos Carrasco's salary was, you know, something that they could definitely do in order to make the trade happen. Did they get enough back for Lindor? It remains to be seen. Certainly the year that Ahmed Rosario had at the plate made it really look like a good trade in Cleveland's favor. And it remains to be seen if Andrés Giménez can produce, the way that he's expected to over the next, few years for Cleveland.
Yeah, definitely. The immediate results, you know, favored the Cleveland. The long term, we don't know. But, you know, Carrasco was hurt most of the season with the hamstring injury. Lindor really struggled big time in his first taste in New York. And like you said, Rosario was a hitting machine. So played a decent shortstop. And, you know, Giménez, we still don't know about. But, he had some moments.
We jumped to January 30th, at the end of the month. Eddie Rosario, the big signing, the big move for Cleveland in the offseason. They give a one-year, $8 million contract to Eddie Rosario. Eddie Rosario didn't last very long in Cleveland and didn't produce. This was a guy who came over from Minnesota, where it seemed like every time we looked up, he was hitting multiple home runs against the Indians for so many years. And then he comes to Progressive Field and it's a mausoleum for him. He can't hit the ball.
Yeah. That was a disappointment. Definitely. In 1 year, $8 million. And he looked just uninterested to me. I don't know if he was got shocked by the trade, or I mean being non-tendered by the Twins, but that Eddie Rosario that played until July in Cleveland was not the Eddie Rosario we saw torture the tribe for 6 years as a member of the Twins.
Well, and I think the most frustrating part about that is, you know, that Eddie Rosario was still there because we saw him reemerge in the playoffs. Yeah. He hit everything. He was the MVP of the National League Championship Series for the world champion Atlanta Braves. I think Cleveland did him a huge favor by trading him and letting him move on. But, you know, it's the most Cleveland thing ever. It's the most Indians thing ever. The guy that you have for what, 3 months, three, 4 months of a season, you expect something out of him. And then he goes and delivers it for somebody else and takes him to the World Series.
Yeah. That was like, I don't know if when they traded him, he was hurt. He was on the, right. The IL. And then even when he came back at the end of the regular season, he hit better than he had in Cleveland. And, you know, I just think, you know, the thing that sticks in my mind about Rosario is he said he didn't think it'd be this cold in Cleveland. And, and that drove me crazy because he was playing in Minneapolis for his whole career.
It's even colder in Minnesota. How do you even, I don't even get it. All right. Well, disappointment in one Rosario, turned into, excitement over another Rosario. Ahmed Rosario came over, like we said, in the Lindor trade. And we really didn't know what was going to come of that, because out of training camp, Andrés Giménez was the starting shortstop. He was the guy that had won the job, and he hit in spring training and, you know, played really good defense. And then all of a sudden you've got Ahmed Rosario on March 16th starting his first exhibition game and making three errors in center field behind Shane Bieber. And you were convinced after you saw it that it probably wasn't going to last.
Yeah, that was a disaster in the making. And give Rosario credit. He hung in there. He got a little better in center field. He made some starts out there in April for Cleveland. But finally, you know, when he moved back to when Giménez struggled in May, and they made the switch. He got sent down. Rosario moved back to short. And after that, it was he took the shortstop like he played there forever, and he had played there forever. But the big thing, Joe, was offensively what he did.
Right, yeah. He turned himself into probably the most dangerous hitter in the Indians lineup after moving back to shortstop. I mean, he was hitting it for the most part in front of Jose Ramirez, so that definitely helped. And we've said that a lot about a lot of different guys. You know, you think back to Oscar Mercado and his rookie season, and, you know, hitting in front of Jose Ramirez really helps.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
It really helped Ahmed Rosario, and he became, a guy who, when he got two hits in a ball game, you know, you expected him to get three or four, and it happened like five, six, seven times this year where he got four hits in a ball game. Just a totally unexpected offensive season out of Ahmed Rosario. And you could just point yourself all the way back to that March 16th start in center field and say, man, what were they thinking? But, you know, it all tended to work out. Moving on, we get to opening day, April 1st. We're in a snowstorm in Detroit. I remember going down to the hot dog stand on the concourse in Detroit and just I couldn't get my credit card out of my wallet to pay for the hot dog. My fingers were so frozen, and the flurries were coming down. The pictures were so amazing. And there's Shane Bieber and Matthew Boyd going at it like it was game seven of the World Series, the two of them pitching. What a brilliant pitching matchup. Bieber winds up losing because the Indians basically just couldn't hit the ball. But, you know, you look back at Bieber's month of April, and he was as dominant as any pitcher has been. He just continued that Cy Young momentum from the year before.
Yeah, definitely. He was off to a great start. I remember, you know, you sit there and you're watching a Southern California kid, you know, pitch in a blizzard. And he looked like he was loving it. You know, he just like, you know, big snowflakes. He said he'd never seen snowflakes that big. And, you know, I think maybe he got a little bit overused in the early going, Joe. That may have led to that shoulder injury that, you know, kind of really sidetracked his season.
Yeah, and, you know, expect them to take a lot more care with Beaver this season for sure, coming off of that shoulder injury. But his strikeout numbers are still there. We saw when he came back at the end of the season, he was still able to strike guys out. He was still able to pitch effectively. So that's got to give Shane a lot of confidence moving into his offseason conditioning. You know, you talk about Shane Beaver, the other end of the spectrum, you know, 137 years old is Brian Shaw. We didn't know what to expect out of Brian Shaw coming out of spring training. And Brian Shaw turns out to be, you know, the life raft for this Indians bullpen throughout the season. He came in, he was consistent. He sort of tailed off maybe in August and September, but, you know, through the first 3-4 months of the season, Brian Shaw was as good a reliever setup guy as there was in baseball.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. 81 appearances, Joe, how do you replace that? You know, he led the big leagues in appearances, what, at 32, 33, set the, you know, the franchise record for relief appearances by a relief pitcher, passed his good buddy, Cody Allen. Just a, you know, an amazing performance. And yeah, he ran out of gas at, I think, a little bit in September, but that didn't stop him from going out there. I think that last weekend he pitched 2 or 3 times against Texas to get to 81 appearances.
Yeah. The stories are classic, just of, you know, DeMarlo Hale telling Terry Francona, hey, you know, Brian Shaw is in my office every day telling me he wants to pitch. And Tito sort of knows. He's like, yeah, I know, that's what Brian Shaw does. It's just come to expect it. And there are days when you have to tell him no, but you can't mention Brian Shaw without mentioning Blake Parker. He was a late invitee to spring training. Didn't make the club out of spring training, but got called up. You know, he to his credit, veteran guy, he didn't have to go to Columbus. He spent the early part of the season in Columbus, came along, and, you know, really provided depth and innings and really experience and guidance for some of those guys in the bullpen.
Just a great addition. You know, this guy's been around. He's, you know, been around the big leagues. He's closed games. He's pitched in middle relief. He's done just about everything. And, you know, that experience really, really helped this bullpen, you know, just a great job by Parker. And he pitched, you know, the longer the later the season got, the more, you know, leverage situations he pitched in, and did a pretty good job. You know, he did okay.
Early in the season, the bullpen, the back of the bullpen role was sort of up in the air a little bit. Emmanuel Classe really sort of stepped forward and grabbed that role as the closer. And now you're looking at the Corey Kluber trade and going, wow, this is really what they had imagined and hoped would be the case. You've got your closer here for several more years now. 24 saves for Emmanuel Classe. It was between bouncing back and forth between Classe and James Karinchak. And we saw what happened to Karinchak. We'll talk about that in a minute or two. But really, Class A just sort of stepped up, and he was one of the most valuable players on the roster last year.
Yeah, after the All-Star break, he really took that job and ran with it, Joe. Over 46% of his pitches were 100 miles an hour or more. I mean, it's just, you know, what we're watching here is incredible. I've been covering baseball for a long time, and I've never seen a guy throw that hard that consistently. I don't know how that happens. You know, just, I really don't. I still don't.
There were games that he came in at the end of the game and the opposing hitters were completely overmatched. They had no chance against a 100 mile an hour cutter that moved in on their hands, and just, they could not put the ball in play. And if they did, it was nothing, you know, dangerous. He really was the epitome of what you hope you have for a closer. Now it's just a matter of, you know, does he get enough experience? And over the next couple of years, by the time the Guardians are ready for a playoff run, is this the guy that you want with the ball on the mound in Game 7 of the World Series?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And you could see the longer he pitched, the more confidence he got in that spot. And you know, this guy from spring training wanted to be the closer, and he certainly showed that he was up to the task, equal to the task.
Okay. Speaking of pitching, Cleveland suffered, you know, probably we thought that the 2019 season was pretty bad in terms of the devastation to the starting rotation, the injuries that they suffered with Corey Kluber breaking his arm and Mike Clevinger and all that. This was just about as bad. Bieber going on the injured list with a strained shoulder. Aaron Civale going on the injured list with a sprained finger. And Zach Plesac breaking his thumb while taking off his shirt in the locker room. We've seen this before. We've seen the rotation, you know, sort of get, you know, devastated this way. What do you think of the job that guys like Cal Quantrill, Tristan McKenzie, and the younger guys who stepped into the rotation were able to do?
I just saw, you know, it didn't look pretty at times, Joe, but they certainly did a great job. Cal Quantrill, like, came out of the bullpen, and, you know, he's going to go to camp next season or this spring as a member of the rotation. He was one of the best pitchers in baseball after the All-Star break when he went 7-1. Just a great showing by him. And to be prepared, not only to be prepared, but to take advantage of the situation. Just a great job.
So going into this rash of injuries, you had Aaron Civale basically leading baseball with in wins and innings, and, you know, looking like he was on his way possibly to some sort of Cy Young buzz at some point. But then, you know, he has to miss 2 months with the finger injury. Shane Bieber, obviously the same way. He had that momentum and it sort of tailed off once the injury became apparent. You replaced him with a guy like a Cal Quantrill who, like you said, it took a little bit for him to get leveled up from the bullpen to the starting rotation and stretched out. And once he did, he sort of took off with it. Tristan McKenzie came into the season with, hey, you've got the number 4 or 5 starter role. He sort of was a letdown in April, but that's not unusual to think of with a young guy in Cleveland in April. It's why Tito doesn't like to necessarily bring some of those guys along as early. But once the summer heated up and once, you know, Tristan had made a couple of trips back and forth between Columbus, he finally just hit and stuck in August. And it was, you know, 8 strikeouts in a row, setting the franchise record against the White Sox, or a near perfect game in Detroit. And just, you know, looking like he was delivering on the promise that he had shown in 2020.
Yeah, he had that great stretch of 7 straight quality starts, Joe, after the break. And just, you know, he was as dominant as any pitcher in baseball. And like you said, what, 7 2/3 perfect innings against the Tigers? You know, we at Comerica Park, I thought he was going to get it. I've never been more confident that a guy was going to throw a perfect game than that game. Maybe Carrasco against Tampa Bay when he was, what, 2 outs and 2 strikes, but that was a no hitter. You know, Tristan just came on. And then, you know, I think that, you know, to me, Tristan is like you said, he's a young guy. He's kind of feeling his way. He found it for 7 games there. Then he kind of, you know, fell off the map those last 2 or 3 starts. But I think it's all a process, you know. You know, Sheldon Ocker told me a long time ago, veteran baseball writer, it takes about 5 years to learn how to pitch in the big leagues. So Tristan is well ahead of the learning curve.
Yeah, that's the hope. And like you said, this was a year where Tristan definitely experienced a lot. He experienced those ups and downs. He came out and said some things, even in the press. And I love talking to Tristan. He came out and said, what, that the moment was too big for him, or he was overwhelmed or something. You never hear a pitcher, you know, say something like that. You know, the Aaron Civale, you know, track, the most dry and boring press conferences after a game. It's just Aaron saying yes, no, you know, this and that. Tristan, you got, you know, sort of a little bit more emotion and feeling out of. He'll be okay. I think this is a big year for him coming up for sure.
Yeah. Let's hope he doesn't take any lesson, you know, speech lessons from Corey Kluber. Just Tristan, just be yourself, because he's refreshingly honest.
Now, Tristan's wasn't the first game where they took a no-hitter or a perfect game. into the late innings. We saw Zach Plesac do the same thing out in Seattle. We thought for sure that, you know, he was heading toward the way he looked that night. It looked for sure like there was no way it was going to end the 40-year streak of frustration over no hitters in Cleveland. But Plesac had his own little bad luck in terms of no hitters. He started three of them this year. Unfortunately, they were all against the Indians. Zach Plesac, have you ever seen anything like that? That's just amazing if you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't even calculate the odds on that. You know, fortunately, you only lost two of them because one was a no decision because he matched Wade Miley pitch for pitch for seven or eight innings until they took Zach out and the Reds scored in the ninth to beat Cleveland. What did he say? He said, "This is insane. I can't even wrap my head around it." And I'm still trying to wrap my head around that.
Yeah, and I don't. You'll never see anything like that again in baseball for sure. After the All-Star break, Cleveland, or around the All-Star break, late June and into July, around that stretch there, they lost 11 out of 12 and basically fell out of the race for the division and then the playoffs. And that sort of prompted the front office to make a series of moves, trading Cesar Hernandez, who was having a career year as the leadoff hitter in terms of home runs. They moved him to Chicago and got back a bunch of prospects, but also allowed a number of these young players, guys like Ernie Clement, Owen Miller, Andrés Giménez, to come back up and get some innings and some games under their belts and see what they had in order to make better roster decisions moving forward.
Yeah, that was, they really had to get a look at this roster, for the second half. Joe, can Zimmer play? Can Mercado play? What about second base? Let's look at Owen Miller, Giménez, Ernie Clement. Where are we with those guys? And bring up Bobby Bradley. Let's give Yu Chang a chance. Is Yu Chang a player or not? And so, you had to clear out some veteran guys to open up that opportunity, that kind of opportunity.
And around there, you saw Bobby Bradley hits a walk-off home run, I believe, on July 3rd. There's all sorts of excitement around the team, back-to-back walk-offs, I believe, that week. You mentioned Yu Chang showing a little bit of power like that. Towards the end of July, at the trade deadline, all these moves are being made, and then all of a sudden we get a phone call, and we hear that Terry Francona is going in for more surgery, and he's going to miss the final 2 months of the season.
Yeah, Joe, I mean, as bad as Tito was feeling, I don't think we really got, the full grasp of it because we weren't, reporters still for the second straight year, you're not in the locker room. You're not talking to Tito every day, in the dugout or in his office. You're doing a lot of Zoom calls and you see him limping out to the mound to make the changes, but we didn't see the full picture. And, that kind of caught me off guard. I did not see that coming, but, thankfully, I think it was the best move they could have made. Obviously they weren't going to win the division. Let Tito get these two surgeries done. Give him a head start on the healing process. Let DeMarlo Hale, manage the club. And hopefully, Terry Francona is back in the dugout, as close to 100% as he can be in 2022.
And that's hopefully where we're trending, definitely towards that in this upcoming season. Tito back home in Arizona, still working through his issues, but getting closer to being back there in the dugout with us on a regular basis. We mentioned DeMarlo Hale. We mentioned, fans were back in the park throughout the season, and we got to see crowds, and we got to see, if. Feels kind of weird to be talking about it now with the ongoing spike in the coronavirus, but it was great to have everybody back in the ballpark, at least for those couple of months there, and make it feel like a normal season again.
Yeah, that was great. And they had the COVID restrictions early, 30%, and it gradually increased to full capacity. It was just great to see people at Progressive Field, especially on the weekends. They had great weekend crowds, Joe. And, You know, I think they finished, what, 23rd in attendance overall, 1.17, something like that, or one, maybe 1.7. But I don't know. I don't think it was 1.17, I think. But, you know, it was just good to see people in the stands, hear the fans again. And I think the, you know, the players responded to that.
Right. And we got to see a final home game as the Cleveland Indians. One of the storylines throughout the entire season was this sort of overhanging idea of they're going to change their name. It had been decided before the season started that they were going to change the name. The new name hadn't been announced yet. July 30th, they came out and made the announcement that it was going to be the Guardians. And then on Monday, September 27th, they brought Kansas City in for the final home game at Progressive Field as the Indians. We all sort of got to be there and witness it. And it was really downplayed by the franchise, and I understand why. But for a lot of people, it was a pretty meaningful day.
Yeah, big emotion at the ballpark, Joe. You know, I remember the signs, you know, the Chief Wahoo signs with tears rolling down his face. And, you know, just, you know, it was cool just to walk through the crowd and just see what everybody was wearing, you know, just the tradition of it, the look back into the past, that's never going to change. I mean, the name changes, but, you know, I think the way people feel about the Cleveland Ball Club, the Guardians, the Indians, whatever you want to call them, you know, that doesn't change. I mean, you can get mad. Yeah, you can get mad, but, you know, that's the way it is. But, you know, the thing I remember most is the players coming out at the end of the game and congratulating the fans.
Yeah, that salute was a nice gesture by the team. And I agree with you. It's you have to move it forward, but obviously you have to respect the fans that were there and the ones that, you know, came out to sort of, you know, say goodbye. And, you know, the signs have been taken down now, the big Indian sign over the scoreboard and all that. There's the change has definitely happened. We were in the park at the team shop when they had their new merchandise revealed and, you know, the Guardians logo and, you know, love it or hate it, it's the way it's going to be for the immediate future. But, you know, it's going to be different. It's going to be, we're going to catch ourselves a million times as we open the Guardian season on March 31st, but it should be very interesting moving forward. And the fans being there, you know, sort of made the whole situation, you know, that much better. It couldn't imagine doing that with an empty ballpark. Another ongoing theme throughout the year was this whole lease agreement and the expiring lease for the Indians at the ballpark for the franchise. And they came to an agreement with the county and with the state. Millions and millions in upgrades will be made to the ballpark that are sort of necessary. But that also comes with pretty much the guarantee that for, you know, definitely over the next 15, but as up to the next 25 years, we're talking 2046. There's the potential that this team is not going anywhere.
Yeah, and I don't think it was ever a threat, Joe. The Dolan family never made a threat that they were going to move if they didn't get this deal done. But, you know, I guess you can, you know, it's out there, you know, it hangs over the whole negotiations. But, you know, I don't think that was ever a threat, but I'm glad it got done. $435 million of improvements. You get the 15-year lease, and like you said, it can extend beyond that. So, you know, that's perfect.
And then once sort of that duck fell into the row, we find out just within the last week that Paul Dolan has been in serious conversations with David Blitzer, a sports management an owner who has a stake in the 76ers and the NBA and the New Jersey Devils and the NHL and several soccer teams in Europe. David Blitzer could be coming on as a minority investor with an eventual path to full ownership of the team.
Yeah, I think this is what Paul Dolan has been looking for since, you know, Sherman sent, you know, sold his shares to buy the Royals. So, you know, hopefully this deal goes through, gives you know, the franchise you know, some stability financially, and can help you know, pay down the debt and maybe, you know, increase his payroll.
Okay. Hoynsie, who didn't we talk about this whole time? I can't believe we skipped over
Jose Ramirez.
Jose Ramirez. Did we skip over Jose Ramirez this whole time? And I guess that's sort of, I guess, maybe a compliment to Jose that he's so consistent and he does his job and it's so expected at this point, you know, of how good he is and how much he carries a franchise. How good was Jose Ramirez this year?
Joe, this guy plays at an MVP level. What, we've seen him do this for the last four of the last 5 years? An MVP mm-hmm. level. I mean, he does it day in and day out. Just a great ball player and just fun to watch. And I think, you know, the fact that, you know, we're not talking about him till the end of this podcast. I mean, I think that's the way he likes it. I don't think he does not seek out the limelight. You know, this is not, I don't know, maybe he's the face of the franchise right now, but he doesn't have that. You know, I don't think that's part of what makes him go. I think the game itself makes him go. He loves the game. He wants to play every day. And, you know, he's approaching 30 and, you know, he's still playing like a rookie. He's still playing like that kid that came up as a utility infielder and, you know, just ran the bases like, you know, people were chasing him.
I mean, if he's in his prime right now, I mean, this is an extended prime. He could go to 32, 33 and still be at this level. We saw him run the bases, I think, better than he has in his entire career this year. He was a magician running the bases this year. Played gold glove caliber defense according to all the metrics, except for errors, which he made more of than he has in his entire career. But just at the plate, there were games and there were times when Jose Ramirez absolutely carried this team. You talk about his influence on guys like Framil Reyes, who hit a ball against the Angels that hit the catwalk and then nearly killed a guy on a bicycle on Gateway Plaza. You know, you see the potential and the pieces there in the lineup, but the whole centerpiece of that whole, you know, everything that makes that lineup tick, it's Jose Ramirez from top to bottom.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Switch hitter, like you said, plays great defense, runs the bases, you know, as well as anybody in the big leagues. And he's a little guy that hits the ball a long way. And he's, you know, he's not up there trying to hit singles. He's up there looking to drive the ball.
Absolutely. All right, Hoynsie, that's going to wrap up 2021. Our last podcast of the year will be off all week next week. What do you say we do this again next year? Same time, same place. We'll come back and wrap up 2022. All right, Hoynsie. Great to talk to you as always. And it's just a pleasure every day of the year to get to talk baseball with you. We'll do it again in 2022 on the Cleveland Baseball Talk podcast.
All right. Merry Christmas, Joe.
Merry Christmas, Paul.